originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I'm joining you tonight from our Lexington, Kentucky studio. And I would like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 206, and also to those of you checking out the website here at horseracingradio.com. .net. So we are big supporters of the PDJF here at the Horse Racing Radio Network. A portion of the proceeds from this show actually goes to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. Now, the PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. And folks, if you're able to help, check out the website at www.pdjf.org. So our guest this evening, well, he comes from a family of racing and started riding at a very young age. But these days, you'll find him in Ohio during the summer, and now he's at Tampa, where he actually helped me start out as a young rider back in the day. He's been riding professionally for 20 years, and he's won 2,019 races and over $28 million in earnings. Ricky Feliciano, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me, Christina. How are you?
I'm doing very good, Ricky. So glad to have you here on the show. I got to start off by saying the funny story when we had Jose Ferrer here on the show. Come to find out, you were in the background listening.
I was. Yeah. I was trying to be nosy.
Well, you know, nothing wrong with that. And, you know, we rode together back in Tampa, so I thought, hey, this is a great opportunity to get Ricky on the show. So,
yeah, thanks.
Ricky, how's the Tampa meet going for you?
Well, I got down here a little later than I usually. I usually get here the beginning of the meet, but got down here about a month ago. I had some things I was taking care of up in Ohio, so you know Tampa. It's everybody's migrating down from up north. There's, you know, a million riders. And it's always tough, but I just try to make the best of it, have a good time, you know, my off days or whatever, I'll just, you know, go fishing or to the beach or whatever. But Tampa, you know, Tampa's Tampa. it's always tough in the wintertime, but, you know, you just try to keep your head above water and stick it out until you make it back home.
Yeah, there's always million riders there, seems like, because everyone wants to enjoy the sunshine. Can't blame them. not at all, Ricky. I still question myself. I was there my first year of riding and I never went back, and I'm still trying to figure out what's wrong with me, because
it was a good time, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was awesome, and it's a great place to spend.
When was that, the last year you was there?
That was 2010. That was my first year riding, so.
Wow, time flies.
God, doesn't it? I mean, see, that was 7 years ago. God, that's insane. That's insane. And Rick, you helped me out so much, you know, when I was green as grass and still learning the ropes and everything like that. And do you think that's important? I wanted to ask you, do you think that's important, helping out the younger riders?
Oh, definitely. I mean, we've all been there, and we're always looking for help, you know what I mean, especially when you're starting out. You know, you want to learn the right way. And, you know, of course you hear a million different kind of ways to do things, but, you know, you try to choose the best, what's best works for you and stuff. But, yeah, I mean, I always like to help if I can. You know, I know I was there at one time, and I was greener than grass, you know. And it's definitely good, definitely good.
Yeah, plus, I mean, the way I always looked at it, you know, we're all out there, all of our lives are on the line, and if you have someone who doesn't really, you know, get something or needs help with something, well, you're saving everyone, really, because...
Oh, definitely, definitely.
You know, yeah. it's a dangerous job, Ricky. The ambulance follows us around there every day, so...
You know it, you know it.
Dangerous job. But anyway, I want to get started here and go back to the beginning. I want to hear how Ricky Feliciano first got involved with racing. And you come from a family involved in racing, is that right?
Yes, I do. Yes. My father, he's been a rider since the early 70s. And I have an uncle, Miguel Feliciano, that he's trained since the early 70s. And, you know, I was fortunate that I grew up, you know, having access to people in the racing game. I mean, that's a big help right off the bat. And, yeah, I always knew in high school I was, you know, that's what I wanted to do was be a jockey. I grew up watching, you know, my dad ride. And to me, that, you know, he still is. That's my hero, Benny Feliciano. And finally, when I graduated, I started, you know, my dad made sure he wanted me to graduate first before I even started getting on horses and galloping and stuff. And so I graduated from Bedford High School up in Ohio. And I started working pretty much like most newcomers do. You know, you start from the ground, you know, cleaning stalls and all the bottom work underneath the horse. And I was fortunate enough to get a job in the jocks room as the color man, hanging up colors at Thistledown Racetrack. So, you know, in the morning time, I would do all the work in the morning, then head over in the afternoon and do colors, which was such a big help because, you know, you're in the jocks room all day and, you know, you get to be around the jockeys all day. You know, you just listen to the stories after the races. You watch races all day. And you know, I come out with a lot of good people in Thistledown, you know, back in the days. You know, there was the Michael Rollins, you know, a lot of old school riders, Tommy Myers, there was Gene Sykes, good riders. And they all helped me and you know, you know, I just went step by step. I had to put in my work just like everybody else. And then next thing I did was a spot came open to be a valet. So I ended up doing that for about 3 years while I was galloping and still learning, you know, in the morning times with, you know, my dad, you know, helping me out. And that helped me a lot. You know, like I said, just being in the room every day and watching races all day. And listening to the riders and stuff, that was a very big help. And then, of course, when my dad gave me the okay, that's when I started riding, which was 97, like in June of 97, I started riding with the bug at Thistledown.
So, Ricky,
and that's pretty much how I came up.
That's how it all started, Ricky. So, how old were you when you first sat on the back of a horse?
Well, I was pretty young. I was 9 or 10 years old, I think. You know, we've all had, you know, a lot of people have, you know, sat on, you know, ride the ponies, the little ponies and stuff as you're a kid. But, like, actually, like, gallop a horse. I think I galloped when I was, like, 9 or 10 on a farm.
Wow.
You know, my dad put me on a pony in the pasture and we would gallop around in the pasture, you know, just like a little easy pony, going pony, you know what I mean? But
yeah.
I didn't start galloping, you know, like real thoroughbreds until I finished high school. That's when he really, you know, I got serious about it. My dad let me get serious about getting on horses.
Yeah.
Because I didn't have too much, you know, I ended up growing in Ocala, growing up since I was younger, you know, like from 4 to 13 years old. So Ocala's like, they call it horse country. So I was always around horses and stuff like that, but I never really got on horses. I was always playing with the other kids and stuff, I didn't pay no much attention until I got older and started coming around the track when I was 17, 18 years old after high school.
I did hear that you rode in a race in Ocala when you were very young.
I did. They used to do a one day of the year at Classic Mile. I believe it was called Country Day at the Races. And I think I was 11 years old. And my dad, of course, had told me about it. And, you know, I was all about trying to do it. And I didn't have any experience on getting on horses. But a friend of my father's, I don't remember his name, he was a blacksmith, had a little Shetland pony. And he said that we could use the pony for the race. You know, they had a race for little kids. Mm-hmm. It was just a quarter of a mile. And so my dad said, look, you know, if you want to ride in this race, you do have to prepare for this race, you know. And so we, you know, about a month before the day, we went every day to this guy's farm, and I would gallop that little pony. He said, you got to get the pony fit. And sure enough, I would go every day, and he'd show me how to put my feet in the, you know, in the stirrups and all that stuff. And every day I would go and gallop for a little while. You know, we'd spend about 45 minutes every day with this little Shetland horse. I think her name was Coco. And sure enough, come day race, you know, it was a three-horse field. And actually it was two, so they had to put a quarter horse in the race just to kind of, you know, make it a little more interesting. Mm-hmm. But I run third. It was just a straightaway.
Yeah.
And so I did hit the board.
I love it.
But it was fun. I had a blast. You know, it was just a quarter of a mile. But, you know, I had my dad's pants on and the boots. You know, I thought I was the man. You know what I mean?
That's awesome.
But that was it. After that day, I didn't really keep getting on horses or anything like mm-hmm. that. I just went back to playing and being a kid. You know what I mean? But
yeah.
It was a cool experience. You know, in my mind, I still always wanted to be a jockey. Like, I knew when I got out of school, I was like, that's what I don't care how tall, how big I'm going to be. I'm going to make sure I'm going to make it happen. And luckily, I was blessed with a body that, you know, to be able to be a jockey, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's awesome. And what did your dad think whenever you were obviously leaning towards the idea of riding races? What did he think about that?
Well, my dad, my mother and father, they always wanted, you know, they would have rather me go to college and get, you know, a more better education, you know, just in case something happened. But, you know, they were going to back me up for whatever I wanted to do, no matter what. And, of course, he knew I wanted to be a jockey, so they supported me 100%. And his main thing was, you know, I did have to finish high school before I started with any kind of work at the track, mm-hmm. which was very, you know, I appreciate that now because, you know, you see a lot of young riders start and they drop, you know, they start making money and they drop out of school and they start riding. They forget about education. That's such a big part in life, you know what I mean? Because mm-hmm. you make all this money and then, you know, you got to, you know, after that, you got to know what to do with it after that, you know?
So many you see don't really.
You see it every day. Oh, it's so sad. You see all these people make this money and then, you know, 5, 6, 10 years later, they're down and out, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They're broke and it's sad.
Well, and obviously riding is not exactly a stable career. You have injuries and, you know.
Definitely not.
So you got to know how to prepare for the future, you know, worst case scenario kind of situation. So, and
did your dad have a plan B.
Right. You have to. And did your dad, did he also try to teach you about saving money and handling your finances?
Definitely. And you know, with my father, he had an unfortunate setback back in 81 mm-hmm. in Arlington Park. He got suspended, and fortunately, they gave him life. He was set up with an anonymous phone call, called up and said that he had a machine in his car.
No.
So they came in the morning time while he was galloping, and they grabbed him in Arlington Park, and they said, listen, we have an anonymous phone call. It says you have a machine in your car. We need to search your car. Of course, my dad, you know, said he didn't have anything, that, you know, he gave him the green light to go ahead and search. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, you know, there was one planted in his glove compartment, I believe. And he had that changed his life, all of our lives, really. And, you know, at the time, my dad was doing very well. You know, he was top 10 in the nation. You know, he was going on to have a big career until that setback. And unfortunately, in the state of Illinois, when you get caught with something like that, you know, they hit you pretty hard. And they gave him life, you know, mm-hmm. banned from the racetrack. Couldn't even go to the racetrack to watch the races or anything.
Wow.
So, you know, I learned a lot when I was young, you know, with my family. Of course, back then I didn't understand a lot. But now, you know, when we talk about it, you know, my dad was doing very well at the time. And the little money he had saved went so fast, you know, and lawyers and this and that. And, mm-hmm. and my father, you know, he didn't have the education that I did. You know, he came from Puerto Rico at a very young age. He didn't fit. I think he had like a sixth grade level of education before he started riding. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he didn't invest his money right or anything. So the little money he had, you know, everybody knows when you're not making money, no matter what you got in the bank, that goes very fast.
It's quick. Oh, yeah.
So it set us back, you know, and I think he filed for bankruptcy, and that's how we ended up in Ocala. And, you know, we were there for about 9 years. He was set back. And fortunately, he kept fighting in the courts, and they finally reinstated him and gave him his license back. So he was able to ride like another 9 or 10 years. Of course, he lost all his 30s, you know, which is pretty mm-hmm. much the prime of a rider.
Right.
But, you know, he came back when he was about 39, 40 years old. And he rode for another, I believe, 8 or 9 years.
Wow.
And but that taught me a lot. You know what I mean? That was a good example, you know, of why, you know, you always got to have a plan B and C, you know?
Absolutely. What a horrific story. That is just, that's so sad that someone was that heartless and just took that away from him, his riding career for a long, long period. And thank God he was able to ride again. But let's talk very briefly. Give us a brief rundown of your dad's career highlights. I mean, he was a very talented rider.
Yeah, he was set back for about 9 years. And, you know, at the end of his riding career, his passion went to training horses, which the 9 years that he was suspended in Ocala, that's what he ended up doing, because my dad didn't know anything else to do besides mm-hmm. horses. So, you know, he started galloping for money, you know, and getting a weekly paycheck. I think he was making $200 a week. You know, you go from making $2,000 or $3,000, $4,000 a week to making $200 a week.
Mm.
And that's a big reality check, you know,
he
used to tell me. And, my dad was such a hard worker, you know, he did what he had to do and He started galloping horses, and I'm getting a call here. I'm sorry.
No, you're good.
He started galloping horses, and little by little, he would save his money, and he'd buy horses that were, you know, we'd be driving down the road, and he'd see a horse turned out in the paddock, you know, all fat and ugly, and he'd talk to the owner and say, listen, you know, do you want to sell this horse cheap? And he'd buy horses for $200, $300, $400, $500, fix them up, get them ready to run, get them looking, you know, fit, and then he'd sell them for a profit. And he did that for about 9 years, and that really taught him a lot about training horses. So his passion eventually went to training horses. So, you know, when he was in his late 40s, he was already, you know, buying a few horses, and he would, of course, run them under my uncle's name, and then he eventually you know, quit riding, and he started training horses. And from there on, you know, he's been a very successful trainer. You know, they say usually jockeys that convert to trainers, a lot of them quite don't make it, but he was one of the few that he remained successful. I mean, he's always a very high win percentage trainer. You know, he just has a few. He never had a big stable. He would only keep, like, you know, between 6 and 8 horses, and always did very well. And that's his passion now. And I still learn every day from him. I can't say that's what I'm going to do when I quit riding, but it is an option for me. It's a good option for me.
Jockey Ricky Feliciano joining me here on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So, Ricky, so you just mentioned, and obviously you're young and you have years left in your career, but you just mentioned you don't know if you would train or not. Do you have anything, you know, in the back of your mind that you would do, like an agent or anything like that?
If I do plan to stay in the horse business, I probably maybe consider maybe an agent or something like that. I don't really think training is for me. Mm-hmm. But if I did stay in the horse business, I'd probably look at maybe being an agent or something like that.
I think you would.
You know, I've been thinking about it a lot lately, the last, you know, couple years, but mm-hmm. I still haven't quite, you know, pick something what I really want to do. I do like cooking a lot. I might jump into some kind of food thing or something, but I still haven't made my decision yet. Hopefully I got, you know, enough years left to hurry up and make a decision. But
you got time.
Got a little time left.
Oh yeah, you would make an excellent agent. In fact, if you do that, I might have to make a comeback and you can be my agent.
Definitely. How long did you end up riding for?
Oh, gosh. 4.5 years, I guess, littered with injuries all throughout, you know?
I do remember that. Yes.
Yes, sir. So I want to go back to, we were talking about the beginning of your career, and you were galloping horses in the morning, you were the color man, and then you worked as a valet, and yes, we're saying it correctly. It's not valet; it's valet in the horse racing industry, of course. But
was I saying it correctly?
You were saying it right. But so, as you mentioned, you know, a valet—that's the guys who clean up our boots and our helmets and put on the goggles and just basically, you know, get everything ready for a rider before they go out for a race. And how long did you do that for?
I ended up doing that for about 3 years. 3 years, yeah. Right when I had to wait, you know, I was a color man when I was 17. I was 17 when I graduated, so I did the colors for about 4 or 5 months, and I had to wait till I turned 18 to be a valet. Mm-hmm. And I was fortunate enough to have a spot open. Somebody retired, and that's how I got in. Of course, I had my father's tack. And, you know, I had a few other riders, and, you know, I just turned 18, and, you know, they paid 10% to the valet in Cleveland. And, you know, I was making between $1,000 and $1,200 a week, which, you know, to me at the time, that, you know, that was great money. I thought I was on top of the world. And, you know, I had a lot of fun. You know, I had my dad was awesome to work for, And I had William Otero, Alfredo Clemente. They were some of the first riders I had. You know, I had, and they were doing very well at the time. And, you know, I was making pretty good money between galloping in the morning and the afternoon work, you know. And a valet can make a lot of money if you have the right riders, you know, and they're doing good. I mean, it's a very fun job, you know, and it's not a very hard job. You know, it's got a little danger factor saddling the horses sometimes, but it's a very fun job, and it's easy, and you have a lot of fun doing it. You know, you get to hang out in the jocks room and gossip with all the guys in the locker room, you know, the locker room talk and all that stuff. But
oh yeah,
it's a lot of fun.
And plus you got
I learned a lot.
Yeah.
That, you know, that was a big help. Big help.
Had to be. You know exactly what goes on in the room even before you start your riding career. And how many riders does a valet typically have?
I would say average, you know, they usually have between 2 and 5, I would say, is a good number. You know, of course, there's some valets that have more. There's some that have less. But usually you keep between 2 and 4 or 5 riders at a time. Sometimes it gets a little hectic. I mean, you have, you know, let's say you have 4 riders and they're all riding a lot of horses every day, it does get a little hectic because, you know, you got to prepare all their stuff for the next races and you got to have everything. You know, you don't have time for little mistakes, grabbing the wrong colors and doing this and that. You know, you got to keep them intact and have them looking sharp when they walk out and have their stuff looking clean. And you got to take care of the tech, you know, the right way because, you know, they're riding out there and, you know, you got to be able to pick up sometimes when saddles and stuff look like they're going to break, the webbings and stuff like that. You got to take care of all that stuff. But it was real cool. I was fortunate enough to be able to do that before I rode, and that was a very big help.
So you're doing this while you're galloping, and eventually you decide that you're ready to start riding races. And when, how did you know? Did your dad, was he watching you, and he kind of decided, yeah, you know what, you're ready, you're working horses, you're breaking from the gate, you're ready to go? How did that process happen?
You know, you're galloping, you know, quite a few horses every day. You know, of course, you got to make sure you're fit enough to be able to get around there. And, you know, I was breezing a lot of horses every day. You know, it's hard to say, but, you know, my dad just kept watching me and, you know, just that day came to where he thought, you know, there wasn't much more I was going to learn in the morning, you know, unless I actually got in and just started riding. And, you know, that came, I think, in June. And he felt that I was just ready. You know, I was fit enough. And you know, he thought it was time for me to, you know, actually ride an actual race course. I had a, you know, ride the first 2 horses I rode. I had a, you know, you don't quite get your license until the stewards see you ride your first 2 races. And, John Gachardo put me on my first horse. You know, he gave me a horse that was, you know, a class horse, an old class horse that, you know, he pretty much took me around there. And, you know, I ran back in the pack somewhere, but, you know, everything went pretty smooth. And I rode 2 the first day I rode. So, you know, I got to ride my first 2 the first day. So, you know, the stewards watched me and everything went pretty smooth. And I made it around there straight. I kept it straight. You know, I don't think I broke very well the first one I rode. My horse kind of threw his head up out of the gate. I probably grabbed him too much a little bit, but we made it around there safe. And they finally gave me my license after the first day. I was so happy. And, you know, of course, after you ride your first, you know, couple races, I wanted to just jump back in. And I wanted to ride more. You know, you got that fever. And, It was all set from there, you know.
Well, we will hear more about those early days of riding for jockey Ricky Feliciano after this short commercial break. Stay with us. You're listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Being a jockey may be one of the more dangerous professions in all of sports. In a split second, you can go from the top of the standings to never being able to stand again. I'm Mike Penna, and over the years, I've had the privilege of talking with many of the top jockeys in thoroughbred racing. And to a person, they will tell you that on any given day, before any given race, when they get a leg up, there's no guarantee they'll return the way they left. It's simply the reality of being a jockey. The Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund does amazing work, providing financial assistance to some 60 former jockeys who have suffered catastrophic on-track injuries. Since its founding 10 years ago, the PDJF has disbursed over $7 million to permanently disabled jockeys. And I'm proud to say that the PDJF is the official charity of the Horse Racing Radio Network. But the only way they can continue helping those disabled riders who have given our sport so much is through your generosity and support. So I encourage you to visit pdjf.org and start making a difference today.
This is CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. James Graham had a great week as he won the Mardi Gras Stakes aboard Rapid Rhythm at the Fairgrounds on Tuesday and the John Battaglia Memorial aboard It's Your Nickel at Turfway on Saturday. Graham finished in the money on 48% of his mounts with 3 wins, 4 seconds, and 3 third-place finishes. Julian Leperu led North America in stakes wins with 3 as he won the Here Comes the Bride aboard Dream Dancing, the Fred Hooper aboard Birdsong, and the Canadian Turf aboard Heart to Heart. Leperu finished the week with 4 wins and 4 third-place finishes. Florent Giroux increased his lead to 28 wins in the Fairgrounds rider standings last week. Giroux led North America in wins with 10 and added 5 seconds and 6 third-place finishes. Finally, the Jockeys Guild Jockey of the Week, Javier Castellano, had a great Saturday at Gulfstream as he won the Mac Dermida aboard Wake Forest and the Fountain of Youth aboard Gunavera. The Venezuelan led North America in earnings by winning an impressive 37% of his mounts. Castellano finished the week with 7 wins and 1 third-place finish. John Parada's newest book, Half a Chance, is available now at JockeyTalk360.com. Half a Chance is the story of a down-on-his-luck jockey agent who finds himself entangled in a web of deceit and larceny and provides the kind of entertaining read that is ideal for any racing fan. Visit JockeyTalk360.com for more information. This has been CJ Johnson with your Jockey Talk 360 weekly update. For all the latest news in the jockey world, visit JockeyTalk360.com and follow us on Twitter at Jockey Talk.
This is Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I'm joined tonight by jockey Ricky Feliciano. And Ricky, before the break, we were just talking about those very early days in your career when you rode your first 2 races in the same day. And I know, thinking back to my own first race, I thought I was fit as can be. I was going to the gym and running every day. And I tell you, and galloping, I was galloping a ton of horses before I started riding. But I tell you, I rode my first race and my legs were just so tired. And did you get that same feeling after your first race?
I did. I did get tired. I mean, besides being thinking you're physically fit, you know, your adrenaline's going, and you get. I did get very tired. You know, put your stirrups up pretty short.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You're thinking you're looking pretty and. My horse wasn't a very fast horse, and we all know when they're coming down the lane, not going very fast, it's even more tiring.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah, I did get the wobbly legs.
Well, I think I forgot to breathe, too. I think I was so excited.
You forget to breathe.
Yeah. It is. And you don't...
Yes, I did get tired.
You don't realize, like, when you ride, you use muscles that you didn't even know existed, you know, and it's really hard to get those muscles strong because, you know, anyway, other than to just ride races. And so you started out and, you said you kept them straight and, they gave you your license.
Yeah.
And that was where again?
That was in Thistledown.
Thistledown. And so did you stay there with your bug, or where did you go?
I started there, like I said, in June, and I rode there to the winter time, and I got a call from an agent out in California, Wayne McDonald. He called me through another friend that recommended me from Cleveland. His name was, man, I can't even remember. I think it was Doug Matthews, I want to say, a trainer, had been doing business, buying and selling horses through California with Wayne McDonald, which was an agent. And he mentioned me, and he watched me, you know, ride some races. So he gave me a call in the wintertime of 97, and he asked me if I was interested in going to California, Bay Meadows and Golden Gate. And, of course, I was so excited. I was like, definitely, yeah, I would love to go out there. So I ended up going out there, like, in December, and I ended up staying for about 3 months. I got to ride for some very good trainers, Jerry Hollendorfer, Mark Glatt, Steve Miotti, and, I ended up doing okay. I didn't do real, real good, but I did okay. Mm-hmm. I went probably 15 races out there, and after about 3 months, business kind of went dead for me, and I ended up getting a call while I was out there to go to Laurel back out east, which, everybody knows with the Bug, that's a very good place for a Bug to go and ride a lot of races. A guy named Benny Feliciano, also the same name as my father. We're no relation, though. I believe they're Italian. And, he called me to come out to Laurel, and at the time I wasn't doing any good in California. So, I considered in going out there, and I ended up going out for about 3 weeks. I ended up in Laurel, and I couldn't quite get going like I wished, And then that's when I got another call to go to Chicago Sportsman Park. I got a call from a trainer, Pat Cucurullo, who had a big string of horses at the time. And he ended up hooking me up with an agent out there to come and he said he was going to help me get started. So I ended up shooting out to Sportsman Park, and that's where I ended up finishing out with my Bug. And, of course, Sportsman Park, I don't know if you know much about Sportsman Park. They got a very long stretch and very tight turns. They got, like, the bull ring turns and a very, very, very long stretch.
Really?
I think it was a 7/8 mile of a track. And but I ended up learning how to get around there and taking turns. And, it was a whole different ball game than riding just a regular mile track, But it ended up going very well for me. I ended up, leading Bug Rider. I ended up hooking up with Jay Fedor, and that's where I ended up finishing my Bug. Of course, when I lost the Bug in 98, business kind of went slow again for me. So I ended up coming back to Thistledown, and I started riding in Thistledown as a journeyman. And I still wasn't quite polished, polished enough to really get going. I needed to find a place to where I could ride, a lot more horses every day. And I ended up getting a call to go to Fairmont Park Racetrack. And I had a very good agent over there, and ended up hooking up with Mark Cooper. And when I went out there the first year, I ended up second in the standings. And then the following year, I stayed there and ended up leading rider out there. And that's what really helped my career a lot, because, I was riding almost a card every day. And of course, that's when you learn the most, when you start, when you're riding a bunch of horses every day. That's when that helps a lot, and that really polished me up. And fortunately, I was going to make that my home at the time, but the purses were already small, and then they had dropped even smaller. So I ended up coming back to Cleveland. And at that time was when my dad was just starting, he decided to retire and start training. So my uncle was training also, and he had a very big stable. So I pretty much inherited the stable of my uncle and then the few horses that my dad was training. And that's pretty much what got me started. you know, as far as doing pretty well in Ohio. And I had been there ever since. You know, I did the, you know, summertime in Ohio, and I've been coming to Tampa in the wintertime pretty much, you know, the rest of my career.
So you started out, Ricky, as a complete gypsy all over the place, and now
yeah,
you do the
jumping around a little bit. But,
oh yeah,
you know, I finally found my spot to where, you know, I was comfortable, and you know, Cleveland is home for me. Of course, the money is not the best at the time, but you know, you have to get in where you fit in. You know what I mean? You know, a lot of people. A lot of jocks, you know, we all dream of going to the big tracks and stuff like that, and riding the, you know, at the bigger tracks like California, Kentucky, New York and stuff. But you know what I mean? My thing was, you got to get in where you fit in. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Cleveland was a spot for me. Of course, like I said, I had my uncle backing me up, which was a big help. And, you know, that was home for me anyways, and we did really well. My uncle, you know, always, he was known for having a lot of Ohio breds, a lot of good stake horses, and I ended up winning a lot of races up in Ohio, and a lot of Ohio stake races. You know, I got to win a bunch of those, and it was pretty cool. So, you know, I felt like, you know, that was a spot for me, and you know, I made a good living. You know what I mean? I was able to feed my family well, and It was good. You know what I mean? I felt like I didn't need to go anywhere else. You know, I was very comfortable there, and I still am.
You found your spot, Ricky. And how is it? Because I can't imagine. I mean, it has to be a lot of pressure riding for, say, your dad or your uncle. And obviously, you know, their family, and you want to do well for them. But there has to be a little bit of some added pressure. How was that, riding for your family?
That, you know, a lot of people, you know, that is what everybody says. You know, it can be a little hectic sometimes when you ride for your family and stuff. But I was so blessed with my dad and my uncle. I mean, they're the most easygoing people ever. And, you know, I never had a problem. You know, I've made mistakes in races, but they never were hard on me like that. You know, of course, my dad pointed them out, and I would, you know, try to fix it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But as far as riding for my uncle and my dad, they were awesome. You know, they still are. You know, they're my favorite people to ride for. You know what I mean?
Of course.
I feel no pressure.
Good.
And when I ride for them, I feel very confident, you know, in the horses that I ride for them, because, you know, they work hard, and I know that they got the horses prepared for the races, whether they're 50-1 or 3-5. You know, I always ride the horses like I know they have a very good chance to win, you know.
You have to. And the horses feel that, I think. You know, they pick up on that.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Did your dad and your uncle, do they give you instructions in the paddock typically, or just say good luck?
Of course, in my younger days they did.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But you know, I finally graduated to that spot to where they feel confident in me now, and you know what I mean, they pretty much let me do my thing now. You know what I mean? Every now and then there's a new horse they come across that they know about, and of course they'll let me know about the horse, but they pretty much leave it in my hands, because we all know you can give instructions, but once the gates open, it's a whole different story sometimes. You know what I mean? You have to go to plan B and plan C sometimes. You know what I mean? You try to handicap the race, and you feel like, okay, I'm going to go to the lead on this one or come from out of it. And when the gates open, it's totally the opposite. You know what I mean? So, but they feel confident in me, and they leave it in my hands, and we've always done well. Thanks God.
That's great. And of course, you have to feel even better when you win for them, you know, and keeping it in the family.
It's always a little more sweeter than most. You know what I mean? Any win is sweet, but you know what I mean? When I win for my family, it's always a little bit, just a little more sweeter. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Jockey Ricky Feliciano is here joining me on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Riggy, what would you say your favorite horse you've ever ridden?
Well, it's hard to narrow it down just to one, but I've had my few favorites, like Big Ohio Champion, Majestic Dinner. I would have to say Majestic Dinner, and my uncle also had a very small horse named Bernie Blue. It was probably the smallest horse in the barn, and as a two-year-old, I mean, he looked like a runt, and we would just use him to work with other horses because he would somehow keep up. And we didn't think much of him until we ran him the first time, and the little guy ended up winning by like 15, and he ended up becoming a big champion in Ohio. He wasn't Ohio bred, but he made over $1 million in purses and won, you know, he won a lot of stake races. So just off the top of my head, I would have to say those two horses, Bernie Blue and Majestic Dinner.
Bernie Blue and Majestic Dinner. That's awesome. The run, too, it turns out to be this champion. Who would have thought? Okay, now here's a different question. What's craziest experience, maybe top, I don't know, if you have a couple of them, go ahead and share them. Craziest experience that's ever happened to you in a race?
In a race?
Or in the mornings, or any good stories you have like that?
I can just one right now thinking. I would have to say one time in Cleveland, we broke out of the gate and ended up there was a pack of coyotes living in the middle of the racetrack. And we break out of the gate, and the funniest thing, one of the coyotes jumps out on the track and just starts chasing us all the way around there. I mean, it's something I never forgot. It was pretty cool.
That's bizarre. Yeah, that's bizarre.
There's so many kind of crazy things that happen. I mean, trying to think of them now, I can't even think of them now. You know how it is, you put me on the spot like that, trying to bring up a story, but... There's so many crazy things. I don't know. That was one of the ones that I always remember, though.
Oh, yeah.
For now.
Oh, yeah. That is pretty bizarre. Pretty bizarre. Ricky, how would you describe your riding style?
I'd say the first half of my career, my style was more of a come from behind rider. Mm-hmm. You know, I would, you know, always sit back and kind of, you know, let the pace go, and I'm known to have a good clock in my head, and I was a come from behind rider probably the first half of my career. And then, you know, I ended up going to Mountaineer Racetrack for about 3 years. Of course, over there, that's a very speedy track. Mm-hmm. And it kind of actually kind of helped me, you know, be a better speed rider. So that kind of leveled me out. You know, it's hard to say, you know, I'm pretty much all, you know, it doesn't matter really now. I'm good on the lead or from behind. Mm-hmm. I'm known for having good hands too, relaxing horses. And, but nowadays, you know, it's whatever, you know, if they got to come from behind or on the lead, you know, I feel real comfortable on both of them.
As long as they win, right?
As long as they win, as long as they win.
Well, you were always, I remember, you were always really good breaking out of the gate, you know, getting them to break sharp. And did you find any tricks along the way that you learned to do that?
When I was in Chicago with the Bug, E.T. Baird, which, you know, he was always considered a very good speed rider, and he would help me a lot. You know, he'd always work with me and breaking out of the gate and stuff. And, you know, he gave me some pointers on breaking out of the gate, which helped me a lot. And like I said, when I went to Mountaineer, those for those 3 years, like from 08 to 2010 or 2007 2010, riding on a speed track like that, I mean, you have to adapt and get good at it, otherwise they leave you.
Mm-hmm.
And they leave you in the dust, and mm-hmm. and you know, you can't even make up the ground. I mean, you think they're gonna stop, but they don't. But I think those 3 years in Mountaineer really helped me from breaking out of the gate and being good out of the gate. I mean, it's hard to explain exactly what it is, you know, that to do, but you know what I mean. It's just something that you just learn with experience. But I think that helped me a lot going to Mountaineer and riding on a speed track like that.
Most definitely. Did you ever ride at Charlestown?
I rode one race at Charlestown, and that's another track that I heard that you have to be, you know, a main part of the race is breaking there is the break, you know,
yeah.
Especially with the bull ring turns, you know, you have to get mm-hmm. position very quickly. And I went to ride one horse for my father, and of course I had a lot of speed. I thought I did, and I thought I was pretty good out of the gate at the time, and they left me in the dust. I couldn't even catch up. The horse didn't even run no good or anything. But
that's the thing. You think you're on a quick horse and anywhere else, and then you go to Charlestown, and you're like,
yeah.
Oh, they're all
did
quick.
Did you get to ride there?
I did several times. I would ship when I was riding in Maryland. Mostly when I was in Maryland, I would I'd ship there at night sometimes. You know, Penn National, Charlestown sometimes, and. Oh, yeah, you learn real quick. You got to pretty sharp.
I mean, my hat goes off to those guys. I mean, it's a funny track to learn, man. Mm-hmm. Those guys, man, they're bullets, man.
Mm. You feel like you're on a quarter horse, really. You're just sending the whole way.
Yeah.
You know, for the most part. Yeah.
It's a lot different.
Yeah, going those 4.5 anyway, that's the name of the game, is just get out of the gate. You know, but yeah, you learn real quick how to do that for sure. So you mentioned, you know, I just brought up traveling to Charlestown and such. Have you ever been anywhere internationally to ride?
Not really. 2005, a Jamaican rider invited me to go to Jamaica to ride for a jockey challenge. Andrew Ramsey. Which is, he's like a very big time rider in Jamaica. He's,
mm-hmm.
he's won, you know, a couple thousand races over there. And he rode at Mountaineer at the time, which is how I knew him. And every year they did, I think Red Stripe Beer sponsored it every year, and they had a jockey challenge. And he always knew I was, you know, I used to love. We used to always listen to reggae music and stuff. I was a big Jamaican music fan and stuff. And and he told me, he said, next time they give me, you know, the option to bring some riders, would you like to go? And I said, definitely. And the opportunity came in 2005, and he took me and like 4 or 5 other riders to go to Jamaica, which was a cool experience. And besides that, you know, I've been to the Caribbean islands to ride. I go every now and then. They'll call me and, you know, they'll pay me to go for one day. And that's a cool experience also. You know, they're small tracks, you know, 5/8 of a mile. I think the biggest one is 7/8, you know, St. Thomas, St. Croix, Tortola. Racing is a whole different ball game over there. And, but I was given the chance to go quite a few times, and it was awesome experience going overseas over there to ride.
Well, plus you're in the Caribbean. I mean, how can you not like it, right? Well, you said
beautiful,
it was
beautiful.
Oh my God, you said it was a whole different ballgame over there, though. And how so? Like, was it just the riders, the horses? How is it different?
Well, not so much the riders, but like, as far as medication, like anything goes. I mean, you see guys giving medications, I mean, right in the barn, right before the race. There's no rules of medication, which actually can be, you know what I mean? It's a little scary if you think about it. But, you know, I went to ride for some good people and stuff. But as far as medication, anything goes. They don't actually have, can't gamble like with the teller. They don't have like odds and stuff like that. They just do all the gambling by, you know, word of mouth. You know, my trainer will just be walking and people start hollering to him, hey, you know, give me 5,000, they bet horse against horse, you know, give me 2,000, give me 3,000. And it's crazy. I mean, but the passion of racing over there is so big. I mean, you would never think that they even raced over there, but it's so big, horse racing over there. And it was a cool experience.
Huh. I didn't know it was so big over there. Does it always, you know, draw a big crowd? Is there always a lot of people?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they race like once a month in each island. And I mean, the racetrack is just packed. I mean, the crowd gets crazy. It's like festivals and carnivals, all that kind of stuff. I mean, they do it big. They do it big.
Wow.
It's good racing. Yeah. I mean, they claim horses from, you know, from California, all over the country, for big money, and they bring them over there and they race them. You know, sometimes it's a match race. Sometimes it's 3-horse, 4-horse, 5-horse. You know, they're not very big fields, but there's a lot of money involved,
Really? So as far as, you know, you said there's no gambling and things like that, except as far as pari-mutuel anyway, how do the jockeys make money there? Is it just, you know, we'll pay you this much to ride this horse and this much if you win?
Yeah, they pretty much contract you before you come over, you know, whoever you deal with, talk to on the phone, and you guys set up a contract, and, you know, they'll pay you, you know, $3,000 or $4,000 just to go for one day and ride, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 horses. And, of course, all expenses paid. And whatever contract you have with your guys is how it goes. I mean, my guys, they would just pay me a lump sum, you know, win or lose, and all expenses paid. And that's how we would work it out.
Wow.
And, you know what I mean? It's a fun time. You know, you go race for one day and, you know, in a couple of days, you're back home, you know, with a pocket full of money, win or lose.
You can't beat that in a suntan to go with it, right?
No, definitely not. Definitely not.
Cannot be that. What was the jockstream like there?
Not very big. The jockstrooms over there, no bigger than a small little living room. I mean, you got to bring, of course, when I would go over there, I'd have to bring all my stuff. You got to bring your saddle, your pad, your chamois, everything. You have to bring, and you have to be your own valet. Of course, there's no valets. There's no ponies to lead you in the post parade. You just got to wing it on your own. And it's a little crazy, but it's a lot of fun.
Ricky, I have enjoyed so much listening to all of these stories. And this hour flew by, but unfortunately, we are all out of time. Ricky, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was cool getting a chat with you.
Oh, my gosh. So great to catch up, and wishing you all the best at the Tampa meet. Ricky, folks, if you missed any portion of tonight's show, check out the website, horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Now, be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Della Pina, I am Christina McManigal, and thank you for listening.